Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the LawCast. This week, we're taking a trip back in time all the way to 1997 to take a look at the first ever WWF Raw from Madison Square Garden. Kyush, this was your first time seeing this one?
It actually was. I had seen, obviously, like the two major segments from the show, like kind of in a vacuum without the rest of the show around them. But I never just sat down and actually watched this Raw. It's sort of one of those projects that every wrestling fan means to take up. Is like, I'm going to go back and watch all the Raws and all the Nitros on this like head to head. And I'm just going to watch the whole Attitude Era. And I tried it like 20 times and I've never made it more than like 3 weeks.
The thing I did that was really fun and I still do sometimes is I'll watch the Raw and the Nitro from the same night at the same time. Like,
yeah.
Put one on my laptop and one on the TV and just kind of turn the volume up and down depending on which one has the more interesting thing going on.
And it's one of those things where, like, if I got paid to, like, talk about wrestling and stuff like that, I would do a project like that where I'd be like, and then I'll see which one pulls my interest. And then it'll be like, which one would I have changed the channel to?
Yeah. But instead, we're doing the show for free and have real jobs.
Yeah, I've been doing this stuff for almost 8 years. Nobody has paid me a dime yet, so this is all you're going to get.
Maybe someday. I'm still holding out hope.
I know, right?
Yeah. So this is, you know, I feel like I say this a lot, but one of the more fascinating periods in wrestling history. It's the Monday Night Wars. 1997 in particular is a tumultuous time for the WWF. Stuff is changing really fast. Their big stars are on their way out. But to put it in context, essentially since the beginning of the New World Order storyline in WCW in the summer of 1996, WCW has been kicking the WWF's ass head-to-head. This is square in the middle of the whatever it was. It was an 84-week winning streak.
That's kind of nuts, especially when you put this era in context. Like, that's a crazy long time to be for WWE to be. It's really the only time they've ever been in second place, and it's a long, worrying period.
Yeah, this is the era where it was decreed by Bischoff that Nitro could never lose a quarter hour to Raw. Not only would they not only lose a week's ratings average, but they were never to be behind for the quarter hour, and I think they pulled it off more weeks than not. Things really bottomed out early in 1997. They did this weird, kind of terrible episode of Raw that was a taped house show in Germany with terrible lighting, a crowd that didn't speak English, so they couldn't do talking segments, and just a bunch of cold matches. It was the European title tournament. And this Raw drew just a horrifyingly bad rating. I don't have it in front of me. I'm sure it was under a 2. And of course it did. Even though the matches were really good, this, I think, demonstrates to me it's not really necessarily about the quality of matches. It's about how you're presenting them. And, like, a taped house show from a foreign country with terrible production value is not going to draw people's interest.
I've always wondered what actually possessed them to put this on the air. Was it just that they didn't have the ability to do a Raw because they were in Europe? Did they always
intend to do this? They were really in on Europe as a market. This is why they created the European title. They were still drawing in Europe, even as they weren't drawing in America. And that had been true for several years now. So I think they were feeling like, we're going to do even more European shows. But yeah, I think now when they do a Raw from the UK, you know, it looks just like a normal Raw because they've got the money to have the full production. But they did not have that back then. So instead, it's a house show with, like, hand lighting, barely lighting up the ring.
Yeah,
and they, you know, did live commentary on top of it to try to pretend like, you know, the show was live. But everybody can see through that.
Yeah, like, if you haven't seen the footage of this show, it is legit, like, I would rather watch, like, a backyard CZW show for production values than this. Like, it looks horrible. Like, nobody...
It's amazing that they put it on the air. I can't believe they did.
That's why I always just kind of suspected that they didn't have any choice. But, like, come on. Like, you should have just shown, like, a best of special. This is a disaster.
Yeah. So, as the story goes, and I will say that the Owen Hart British Bulldog match from that show is awesome.
But no one will ever know because not a lot of people have fucking seen it. Yeah.
So as the story goes, the next day, like, Vince gets, I mean, there's like a 9 a.m. meeting, which is never a good sign when it's we're meeting first thing in the morning because heads are about to roll. And like Vince just flips his shit, says last night was a disaster. It's time to make some changes here. And this is when Vince Russo goes from being like an associate member of the creative team to basically the head writer. I mean, Jim Cornette is still involved. Bruce Pritchard is still involved, but Russo's power grows substantially. And you also see some other big changes to the show. Within a few weeks, they change from the old RAW set to kind of the classic Raw set, the big Titantron and the black curtain. That's always what I think of when I, you know, picture the Monday Night Raw set. They change the title of the show to Raw is War, introduced the second hour being called the War Zone. And for a couple weeks, they actually sprung for some music rights and used Marilyn Manson's The Beautiful People is the opening to the show.
It's so funny because that's such a weird team. Even when they used it for SmackDown, it was such a great fit.
That's what I was going to say. Do you remember that they used it for SmackDown for a little while too?
Of all the 56 themes that SmackDown has had over the years, that's easily the best one they've ever had.
Oh, it's honestly like that open, both that opening package and like the Raw opening with the Beautiful People give me chills.
Yeah, it's just so dead on. But I mean, then they got the Anthrax theme that's just so iconic. And like, I hadn't seen that entrance video in a very long time, and it's so much more elaborate than anything else that they would ever do. Like, it has actual people, like, walking through it. It's not just clips.
Where Steve Austin's, you know, walking into this warehouse, and then, like, there's dogs and people, and, like, the warehouse is exploding. It's just like, yeah, every other, like, wrestling show opening is just a bunch of clips of stuff happening.
And that's why really this is easily the best wrestling show opening in the history of professional wrestling. I mean, just the image of, like, first of all, like, Ahmed Johnson and Steve Austin are the only live people who are in it. I don't know why they just chose Ahmed to be in there, too. He's just walking through with a 2x4 while some dogs bark at him. But, like, the image of Austin walking through the door and walking through the flames makes him look like the coolest dude in the entire world.
Yeah. And it's notable that it's him that it's based around instead of Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels. Like, even before WrestleMania 13, it seems like they knew where things were going.
Yeah. I mean, there's no word for attitude yet in the company. Like, they hadn't really gotten there yet. But he so much better encapsulates it than Michaels and Hart do at this point. Like, all of Austin's segments just pop off the screen so much more than anybody else's.
So, and quickly, the storylines take a more serious turn. March 17th, the go-home show to WrestleMania 13 is one of my favorite segments. The Bret Hart, you know, snapping promo where, you know, he curses and he says he was screwed. You know, this is bullshit. Just goes off on live TV, uncensored. And, like, he fights with Vince and he fights with Pat Patterson. And it's just absolutely crazy. And so much better and fresher and different from what they had been doing for than they'd ever done. Like, it's just a totally different tone the product is taking on.
And it's one that's obviously going to be hugely successful. I do love that during this time, like, there's a lot of, like, vaguely shootish stuff that starts happening. Like, basically the entire basis of the Attitude Era was Bret Hart, like, starting to shoot on Vince McMahon, and then Steve Austin starts. I kind of wish they would still be able to find that balance today, because it's still kayfabe, but, like, it's their characters who are mad at Vince. But now that it's just basically all shoot comments about real stuff that happens on Twitter behind the scenes, I like this so much more.
Yeah, where it did a good, like, heightened reality here, where they tried to be like, what would happen if this was real, and how would the guys react, and, like, we're going, you know, Vince McMahon playing a corrupt promoter is the realest thing in wrestling, because every wrestling promoter is corrupt.
Exactly. Like, they're playing around with what you expect these people would be like in real life, but it's still just their characters. And I feel like that's something that we've maybe lost from the industry today.
Yeah. Hart and Austin execute their, you know, famous double turn at WrestleMania 13, and overnight, it flips. You know, Bret is now the top heel. Austin is now the top face. Shortly thereafter, Hart proceeds to form the new Hart Foundation stable with Owen Hart, Neidhart, Davey Boy Smith, and Brian Pillman. And then we get the USA-Canada feud, which stands out to me as one of the coolest things they've ever done, where, you know, the Hearts are heels in America, but their faces in Canada and the rest of the world. So 1 week, Raw's in Canada, and the Hearts are huge baby faces. And then the next week, Raw's back in America, and they're monster heels. And just some huge crowd reactions in this time.
Honestly, like, the Montreal Screwjob has been talked about a million and a half times, and we don't really need to rehash it right now. But one of the worst things that we lost from that was not just Bret Hart and not just, like, the veneer of Shawn Michaels, but, like, we never got a conclusion to the USA-Canada feud. That was supposed to come at that WrestleMania. Like, they were, I think they were just going to go Michaels-Hart at WrestleMania 98. Like, that was the aim, to blow off this feud then. We never got a conclusion to this. And God knows what else they could have done with it, because it wasn't even close to done.
I think WrestleMania 14 would have been Austin finally getting his win over Bret, because they deliberately avoided having him ever pin Bret. He'd, you know, won by DQ or won by countout or won a tag match that Bret was, but he'd never, they were saving that for WrestleMania 14.
That makes sense. And hey, maybe all it did was save us from flag-waving Steve Austin versus Bret Hart, which would have killed Steve Austin dead.
A flag match.
Yeah, oh my God.
But the real hottest feud in the company is behind the scenes, Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels. They got into a real fight in Raw back in June after Shawn not very subtly implied that Bret was having an affair with Sonny on live TV, which is like one of the all-time most unprofessional things that's ever happened.
Is that the notorious hair-pulling fight?
Yeah. This is where Shawn comes in with his thing of hair and, like, slams it on Vince's desk and is like, this is an unsafe work environment, I'm out of here. And he actually went home for, like, 2 months. He came back for SummerSlam 1997 to officiate the Bret Hart-Undertaker WWF Championship match. Bret won the match and the title for an unprecedented fifth time after he spat in Shawn Michaels' face, and Shawn went to hit Bret with the chair. Bret ducked. Shawn knocked out Undertaker, and Shawn had to count the pin because, as per the pre-match stipulation, if Shawn was biased in his officiating against Bret, he would be banned from wrestling in the World Wrestling Federation forever. Bad spot to put your biggest star in. Not sure what the promoters were thinking on that one.
It was a little weird, though. I do love the sort of hybrid four-way feud that they have going on at this time, where, like, Austin and Bret and Shawn and Taker are all kind of feuding with each other. And it's sort of ultimately focuses on the title, but they're all involved.
That's,
so you can just kind
of, I love that they were willing to do that kind of thing here, where, like, that's how, we'll get into it in a second, but that's, like, how DX started, was Triple H was feuding with Mankind, and, like, they, you know, Shawn and Triple H kind of had mutual enemies, and so they just sort of ended up teaming up because of it. And, you know, it grows into DX, but it started off as just like, well, they both have an issue with Mankind, so they're going to work together against him. And it's the kind, you know, Mick Foley's involved in multiple storylines throughout this, because as Mankind, he's feuding with Hunter Hearst Helmsley. But his dude, Love, he's Steve Austin's tag partner and one half of the tag team champions.
And, you know, like, I'm not trying to bag on today's product over and over again.
Yeah, but it deserves it.
Honestly, that is the thing that I miss the most from today's product, is there's no relationship between not only different characters on the show, but between segments. Like, nobody bleeds into anybody else's segment. There's no, characters don't interact with each other outside of the bounds of whatever feud they happen to be in at any given time. Here, like, the beauty of this, they only have, like, 5 stars.
Yeah.
They don't have that.
So they gotta ride them.
Yeah. So, like, Mick Foley and Steve Austin are involved in, like, 46 different storylines in some way or another. The Nation of Domination are in, like, 3 different matches on this show.
Yeah, well, that's why it's better that there's a lot of Steve Austin and Mick Foley, because once you got past those big 5, there was not a lot else on the roster.
Exactly. But like in some ways it's beautiful because then everybody has some sort of relationship with everybody else. So the feuds kind of never end. They can just bleed one into the other. Yep. This person can feud with this person, then feud with their friend, then feud with their brother, then feud with the guy who double-crossed him.
Yeah. So also at SummerSlam, Steve Austin won the Intercontinental title despite having his neck injured on a botched pile driver by Owen Hart. Because he's not been able to defend the title, he's been stripped of both the tag titles and the Intercontinental title. The tag titles were settled in a tournament. The Intercontinental title tournament is ongoing, and we'll have that on this show. I mean, the big thing is Austin wants to wrestle, and the authorities, you know, be it Pat Patterson, Gorilla Monsoon, Sergeant Slaughter, will not let him. He is not medically cleared to wrestle, and he's not happy about that because he's trying to earn a living. He doesn't work. He doesn't get paid.
And it really kind of puts into perspective because this is the time, we're just after the time where, like, wrestling plumbers were around, where, like, wrestling magicians were around, people with, like, actual jobs who just wrestled on the side. It's so refreshing to hear a guy be like, I'm a professional wrestler. That's what I do. That's how I make my money. Stop trying to stop me.
It's just so basic and so relatable. The other big thing going on is the night after SummerSlam, Shawn Michaels wrestled Mankind. Hunter Hearst Helmsley interfered and feud with Mankind. But over the next few weeks, Helmsley and Michaels formed an alliance. China, as Helmsley's bodyguard, is also in the equation. And then they just threw Rick Rude in there for some reason.
I meant to ask you that. Like, why? How did Rick Rude get involved in this? He's not a fit at all.
He's the insurance policy. One night, Sean said he had an insurance policy, and Rick Rude showed up and interfered in his match. I don't actually remember the behind-the-scenes story, but I know they covered this on the Something to Wrestle With episode where they talked about Rick Rude, but I think it was basically like, Rude wanted to come work, and you know they were hard up for stars, so they said, okay, we'll throw him a bone and book him. I think maybe Sean wanted it, but yeah, it's so weird to have the Degenerates and like Rick Rude in his suit.
I mean, Rick Rude obviously was sort of an outrageous degenerate in his day. So like young Rick Rude, I could absolutely see kind of being involved character-wise with this, but he just looks like their dad.
It really does. Yeah, it's a weird fit, and it's, he ends up leaving after the Montreal screw job, and he's kind of erased from history. Like, when they talk about who was in DX, Rick Rude never comes up.
Yeah, the only notable part of that is that he was on Raw and Nitro on the same night when he bounces.
Yeah, shave that mustache to prove it was live.
There you go.
So I think that's the setup for the show. There's a lot of storylines here, but we'll go into them as it goes on. So it's September 22nd, 1997, live from Madison Square Garden in the heart of Midtown Manhattan, New York. Sellout crowd, 14,615. I don't know if that's a sellout, actually. I'm kind of guesstimating that with the size of the set, it was around sold out. Maybe not. The rating was a 2.4 for this show, which was actually down from the previous week, which must have been a real bummer for them when they got that in, but who knows what Nitro was doing this week, so, it bounced around. But the ratings after this would go on kind of a continuing steady incline. They were up the week after and the week after that. And the thing is, I feel like the TV ratings tend to be a lagging indicator. You do a good month of TV before the effect really starts to show up.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of this. Like, if you just look at the card, like, just sort of from a rundown perspective, this isn't like a gigantic must-see, oh my god, how could I not watch this show? It's more like in retrospect, like this is the show that when people tuned into it, they were like, holy shit, I gotta see more. Like it's not, it's despite the fact that they thought it was and they put all their biggest stars on it, there's not enough star power here to kind of like steal attention from Nitro, but anybody who is watching is definitely tuning in next week.
Yeah, well, it's one in a series of strong shows. It sets up a bunch of really intriguing storylines to come. But the other thing is, mostly they're just building towards the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, the Bad Blood pay-per-view, which is 2 weeks away, and that's the focus of this show. So we open with a video package narrated by Jim Ross, just going over the history of the WWF at Madison Square Garden. I feel like I'm saying this a strange amount, that, you know, they didn't acknowledge history much in this era, so it's notable that they did it, but this seems like one of the rare instances where they were kind of looking back on what had happened in the years prior.
I always really liked when they did this kind of thing. And as years would go on, they'd kind of do it more and more infrequently until finally they brought back the Hall of Fame to kind of have some establishment of the history. But, like, I remember, like, that one video they did in, like, 2001 that was, like, the history of WWE narrated by the Rock video song. Yeah. Like, literally, like, and I was like, man, this is beautiful. Brings me to tears. And it's fucking Kid Rock song. Like, that's as much... That's as much treasuring of their history as they did at the time. But apparently, like, even Vince cried, and that's, like, partially responsible for all the history we get now. It's just so funny to think. But, like, they didn't acknowledge this stuff then. Like, yeah, to see Hogan.
To see Bob Backlund, to see Hogan, to see Bruno, who was on, you know, shit terms with the company at this point, you know, was comparing wrestling to pornography at this point. Yeah, you know, I think Superstar Graham is in there. You know, Jimmy Snuka doing the Superfly Splash. You know, really cool. Sets the tone for the show well. And then they proceed to piss on tradition.
It is really funny, though, to see, like, Bob Backlund and Bruno and then immediately go into that opening video where there's fire and explosions everywhere.
I think it draws a good contrast. It was like, that was then, this is now.
Yeah.
Bob Backlund never walked through a flaming warehouse.
Maybe he would have found some charisma in it.
Ooh, boy. So opening match. Yes, Raw opens with a match. It's a miracle. It's from the Intercontinental Championship Tournament, quarterfinal, Ahmed Johnson against Rocky Maivia. Winner goes on to face Farouk next week in the semifinal. The Rock has recently come back from an injury, turned heel, and joined the Nation of Domination, and they just instantly flip the switch from him sucking to him being awesome.
And man, he is great here. Like, how long in the business is he? Like, not even a year?
Maybe 2 years. Like, he debuted at Survivor Series 96, and I think he had, like, he'd done some Memphis before that and, like, worked out with his dad a little bit. But, yeah, he's just a natural. He just got it from day one.
I mean, we always talk about, like, Brock and Angle as being, like, absolute naturals who learned it so quickly. The Rock carries Ahmed Johnson to maybe Ahmed's best ever match here. Maybe that's overstating it, but, like, this is a carry job, and this is a good match.
Yeah, I enjoyed this, and it's so notable. They whiffed so hard on the initial Rocky Maivia character, and they almost ruined him. Like, if he got lucky that he got hurt, and somewhere in that time, they were convinced to just reboot him and turn him heel and start letting him kind of use his natural persona. Because, oh God, like, if they had continued much longer with the blue chipper character, it would have never happened.
Well, this is one of the reasons why anytime anybody gets called up from NXT or whatever and their first run kind of sucks, I always counsel people to have some patience. Because it's important to understand that WWE always whiffs the first time around. Just think back, like, the character they gave Jericho, disaster. Yep. The opening they gave Rock, horrible. John Cena, disaster.
Ringmaster Steve Austin.
Yeah, they always whiff the first time because they don't. It takes time to understand what it is about the character that the audiences are going to get into. So, like, Bayley's not dead. Like, just give it some time, man. The second iteration of the character is what works.
Still waiting for the second iteration of Roman Reigns.
Maybe we're
getting him. I've really enjoyed the last few weeks.
Yeah, this John Cena thing has opened up a whole new world for Roman Reigns.
Yeah. So like we said, you know, a good match. Ahmed had actually joined the Nation back in the summer for like a week before he got hurt, and they kicked him out because he was going to be out for a few months with injury. Ahmed joining the Nation makes no sense. This is after Farouk had called him an Uncle Tom for like 6 months straight.
It was the second worst betrayal of my childhood. I was so mad because I was a gigantic Ahmed Johnson fan. Gigantic. And I honestly, like, I didn't even want to watch wrestling anymore. And like I got banned by my parents from watching it right around this time. So
it's not like for the best.
Yeah, but like I was so fucking pissed. The only thing in my childhood that was worse than this was Tatanka turning heel on Lex Luger, the greatest betrayal I have experienced in my life.
Everybody thought it was Luger that sold out, but
we're gonna do that show one day because I have so many things to say.
What is that, like SummerSlam 94, 95? I can't remember what show.
Something in that, I think 94.
Yeah. So I like this. Ahmed goes over clean with the Pearl River plunge in 5 minutes. I think it was very clear who the star was here, and it was not Ahmed Johnson.
No, everything Rock did looked crisp. He had like a whole array of moves that nobody else was really doing and that looked really great. I mean, he just looks like a star. Like, he just looks like a star.
And Ahmed's fallen a long way here. When we did King of the Ring 96, it seemed like he was the chosen one at that point.
Oh, yeah, they were already inserting him in the main event.
Yeah,
like it's amazing he never got any sort of real run with anyone on top.
He got hurt every time. He was going to face Undertaker for the title at Canadian Stampede, but he got hurt. And that was just the story of his career. He'd start to get a push, and then he would hurt himself.
And that leads to Jerry Lawler in this match burying him by every 5 seconds being like, he's injury prone!
Yeah. That's just when you get into the weird, like, I know he's the heel, but, like, why is the heel telling the truth? Like, heel truth really hurts when it's told.
Yeah, it really does.
Like, that's what really buries you, when it's the heel who isn't lying for once.
And I never really like commentators doing that, because, like, when, like, The Miz does it, at least he's getting heat for a future match, but Jerry Lawler's just burying people to bury him.
Yeah. So they go over what we're going to see tonight. I like that they do this. Here's all the matches. It's not impromptu making matches on the fly. We've got Bret Hart against Goldust. We've got Dude Love against Hunter Hearst Helmsley in a street fight and an interview with Shawn Michaels. And then the glass breaks and Steve Austin appears out in the crowd in the upper deck. And this was awesome.
The show completely changes the second that glass breaks. It's like the crowd had been asleep and they wake up.
It's like the show went from black and white to color.
Yeah, like it's immediate. And the best part is, like, Steve Austin's not, I mean, he's a big guy, but he's not a huge guy. So they pan to him in the audience, and you can't even see where he is.
And this is also, like, if they did this today, they would, like, have 10 security guards clearing the space out, and it would be, like, perfectly blocked and shot so he was right in the frame. Here you can't even see him because there's just a wave of fans. Maybe he had one guy with him, but totally, just it feels totally different. It feels like he's actually just there on his own.
Yeah, it legit is like he just walked in like through the back and was just like, hey! And like all the fans turn around and like, oh shit, it's Steve Austin. Yeah. Like they have that reaction.
And he promises he's going to whip somebody's ass tonight. Great tease as they go to commercial. And next, we get the weirdest part of the show, which for some reason survived onto the network version. The promotion for the laser tag game. Pardon?
This is easily the best part of the show.
Sable is walking around a warehouse with her laser gun when classy Freddie Blassie's disembodied projected head appears and tells her that her first challenger is Howard Finkel. And she blasts him and wins. Definitely had one of those laser things when I was a kid, and it sucked.
Oh, it's the fucking worst. It never worked right. It was
never
a disaster.
You couldn't hit anything. You had to be like, I would put them like right up against each other and pull the trigger and it still wouldn't hit.
Yes, but this is so fucking amazing. Like literally, it's like Sable in like her furl, like spandex, like leather outfit and like sunglasses on, are going around in like what appears to be the same warehouse they shoot the opening video in. While Howard Finkel calls a match, only to take breaks in between calling like announcing wrestlers coming out to be like, gotcha, Sable!
Yeah. Interesting sponsorship deal. I kind of wish that I would watch the 90s commercials for nostalgia purposes if they were included in this.
That's
the one thing you miss. You get from you know, doing rips from online. Obviously much higher quality on the network and, you know, legal, but not having the commercials is a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, it's such a good blast back in time, and I honestly wonder if I actually bought this because of this commercial, because like I owned this exact set of this toy. Like,
yeah,
it really makes me wonder.
I don't think they were still doing this by the time I started watching. So I don't think that was why. I think it's just like every kid wanted one of those because laser tag is awesome and we can play it at home. But no, did not turn out to be like going to the laser tag place.
Nope, it sure isn't.
They show highlights from the One Night Only pay-per-view, which was UK exclusive over the weekend. In the main event, Shawn Michaels defeated the British Bulldog to win the European Championship in front of Bulldog's countrymen, his family, and his cancer-stricken sister, who he dedicated the match to. All-time burial here.
Shawn Michaels is maybe the heeliest heel that I have ever seen in any context in the history of professional wrestling here, which is weird because he's not really... I mean, he's in front of certain fans, he's over so much as a heel. But, like, he's not really booed that much on this show.
There's only one thing that they want to do for, that the fans, you know, get on him for, and we'll get to that later.
He's in this, like, weird tweener area, despite the fact that he's literally, like, humiliating cancer-stricken women.
Yeah, like... And we had talked about doing One Night Only because I love it as a show. It's a great kind of forgotten gem of a pay-per-view. So go check it out if you've never seen it. But it just so bizarre to me that they had Bulldog get beat there. And it's one of the all-time like bullshit political maneuvers where Sean's like, oh, yeah, totally. You can beat me next time. I swear that'll happen.
And it also led to... Sean having the European title, which is one of the all-time, like, why the fuck does this guy have this belt? It doesn't make sense.
The only time he defended it was when he laid down for Helmsley. They just for the Grand Slam champion thing. He wanted to be the only guy who had ever held all the belts, and he got to fuck with Brett by beating Bulldog for it.
What a fucking asshole he was during this period.
A real heel.
Holy shit.
So next out, Undertaker comes out for an interview. I like that it's actually him being interviewed by Vince McMahon here instead of just he's going to come out and talk for a while. Like, it feels more legitimate that, like, there's actually a plan and a format here and he's going to be asked some questions. He just kind of promises that he's going to, you know, send Shawn Michaels to hell at Hell in a Cell. Him and Michaels, the first ever Hell in a Cell match. Vince announces that the winner of the match will face Bret Hart for the WWF Championship at Survivor Series. And then Shawn Michaels shows up, and he is completely fucked up here.
Shawn Michaels is almost, like, manic in how fucked up that he is. Like, he's just... He doesn't make any sense. He's just kind
what
of, like,
is he on?
Dancing around all the time.
He cuts a terrible promo here. Like, he just goes on and on about how unfair the... Like, it's not whining is fine. The problem is Undertaker wants to kill him. Shawn is just standing there at the top of the aisle, and Taker just stands there and lets him talk instead of going to beat him up. It makes no sense.
Also, like, Shawn in no way sells, like, the threat or severity of Hell in a Cell at all. Like, he is not worried in the slightest, whatever. They put a roof on it. It's fine, whatever.
Yeah. All it's missing is the Scott Hall scary fingers.
Right, exactly. And, like, the fact that it goes on to be one of the greatest matches of all time kind of undersells the fact that, like, Shawn Michaels does his best to bury the concept before it even happens.
Yeah. It's just how it was in this era with him. Like, he just was not... I mean, he was on stuff. He was not cooperating. He was not professional. Like, it's amazing they put up with all this shit.
But the problem is, he cuts a shitty promo. He's, like, completely off his shit. He's burying the match. He's just magnetic, though.
Yeah.
Like, I could not take my eyes off of this.
He's so much better. It's just so liberating for him to be a heel here after a couple years of him playing basically the same persona but as a face, just for him to cut loose as a heel. He's so much better as a heel.
Yeah. He's basically, like, nuking the entire world for the joy of it. It's fun to watch.
Yeah. We come back from commercial. Sunny comes out as the guest ring announcer for the match. She gets a massive pop, but they have nothing for her to do. So she's just, like, modeling t-shirts and doing guest announcing every week.
It's really kind of an indictment of them at this time. Yep. That they have Sable and Sunny. They don't have a fucking idea of what to do with either one of them, and they are two of, like, the biggest stars in the entire show. So literally, they'll just come out for segments and do nothing, or, like, hawk t-shirts, or be in laser tag advertisements, but, like...
Yeah, they're not actual characters on the show.
So you can't find something for them to do?
Just have her manage somebody. I mean, have her... Put her with Sean. I think that would have been awesome.
I mean, it's not like they weren't together backstage.
Well, I don't think they were anymore at this point. That would have been part of the problem with that pairing. But she's here to announce.
Can you imagine a heel Sunny with heel Sean? Like, what the level of attitude there?
Nuclear.
Oh, my God.
And that's the proper use of a hot woman with a guy. You don't put her with a baby face. You put her with a heel. The opposite of what they did with Mark Miro and Sable.
Yeah. And that's sort of like a tragic history of WWE is there's some things that Vince McMahon thinks are true that just aren't fucking true. And it's been proven a million times and you'll never convince him. And the biggest one is hot chicks go with baby faces to get them over. That gets no baby face over.
No, that makes it like the guy you like least is the guy who you're kind of lukewarm on anyway. It's like, oh, and he has a woman way hotter than you'll ever have.
Yeah, fuck that dude. What a douche.
So the match is the Legion of Doom against the Nation of Domination. This feud has been going for like 6 months, and it's not really going anywhere. It had kind of been dropped at this point because LOD had been doing more stuff with the Hart Foundation, but just the Nation, they would just put them in these endless feuds. Like the feud with the DOA went on for a year. The feud with the Boricuas, the feud with Ahmed Johnson just never ended.
And I can kind of see why stables were such a big deal at this point, because they had a lot of people with no name recognition, and this way they could just kind of like chuck them all in a stable and kind of get them over by association.
Yeah.
It made sense, and all the segments would kind of write themselves, like, oh, there's four Nation guys, that's three matches, okay, let's just go.
Yeah, it gives something, rather than just having like, comma, the fighting machine one-on-one against somebody. At least when there's stables, it makes it interesting. That's something that I would, you know, credit Russo for. Like, he always was big on factions. Sometimes he went overboard, but I think the show is more interesting when it has some factions on it.
I do know, like, the Nation of Domination is kind of a complex thing, because in some ways it was a really good idea, and in some ways it's a really fucking horrible idea, and I always vacillate between whether I like it or don't like it. It obviously couldn't work today, but if they had just been given somebody to do anything with, like, if they just never had anybody to work with that really made it worthwhile until, I guess, like, DX comes along. But that's when Nation of Domination isn't even hot anymore. You know what I mean? Like, it's already kind of on its way out.
Yeah. So this match, nothing much to it. The most interesting thing to me was that Farouk had put Shamrock on the shelf with a spine buster the previous week. They're only a couple months into Shamrock's run, and he's got internal injuries from one spine buster. I don't think they saw what they had in Shamrock.
No, they definitely didn't.
LOD dominates, the Nation interferes, DQ, Ahmed runs out, and he ends up getting beat up too. Just feud will never end. Ahmed and the Nation, the only thing that stopped this feud is when Ahmed got let go.
Yeah, I mean, literally, like, the blow-off to this feud was supposed to be WrestleMania, where Ahmed teamed up with the Legion of Doom, right? Or was that WrestleMania?
Oh, that was WrestleMania the previous March, right. So this is 6 months on, and it's still going.
Exactly, like, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, like, this is sort of indicative of, like, Russo wasn't in full control yet, because no way does Vince Russo, like, have a feud last 6 months.
Oh my God, no.
Yeah, next up, we've got another match from the Intercontinental Title Tournament. It's Owen Hart against Brian Pillman. Owen is in all his shithead heel glory here. He's got four police officers to protect him from Austin. He's got his leather jacket, his spiked hair, his slammies. So hateable.
I mean, he's like a heat genius at this point. Like, he'll take any little thing and turn it into, like, your annoying little brother who thinks that he's cool. And yeah. It's just genius. And to put
the facial expressions during Pillman's promo, like the looks of faux concern over Pillman's fake injury. So Pillman is out with his arm in a sling. He won the right to own Marlena for a month after he beat Goldust at Ground Zero because women are property and can be bet on in wrestling matches.
That is absolutely horrible. Though, and I feel horrible and scummy for saying this, this is the hottest Marlena ever looked.
Oh, man.
Holy crap.
Yeah, she's in leather and, like, he's got her on literally on a leash. Like, Jerry Lawler is super into the idea of Pillman raping Marlena. Like, really into it.
Fucking Lawler.
It's just, like, it's so telling what fires him up.
It's just funny because later on, when during the puppies era, he'll kind of get away with it by being sort of like the harmless, pervy old man, like from like every anime, where he's just like, hey, boobs, yeah. Despite the fact that in real life, Jerry Lawler is kind of a sex monster who's horrible. But this is sort of the real one, and it's creepy as fuck.
He's still like bad guy king here. Like, yeah, it's not good. This whole storyline was uncomfortable. Where this was probably going was, I think Marlena was going to end up turning on Goldust and joining with Pillman. And whether they were in on it all along or whether he raped her until she would love him, we'll never know. No. Yeah, I know. So Pillman says he hurt his arm banging Marlena last night. Sergeant Slaughter, who's the commissioner, comes out. He calls bullshit. He wants to see the x-rays. He wants to see the doctor's note. I love that, like, Sarge is, like, a smart, reasonable authority figure. Like, he actually sees through the heel shenanigans.
And he's over as a heel during his entire run as this, because nobody wants that. Like, what the fuck do you mean he knows what's going on? Boo!
So he, like, tosses the microphone to Pillman, and Pillman instinctively catches it with his bad arm, revealing the ruse, and Sarge orders them to wrestle and says if they don't, they'll both be banned from the World Wrestling Federation.
I have seen this fake injury angle done probably 10,000 times. This may be my favorite version of it that I've ever seen. From Brian Pillman being like, yeah, I was trying all the positions in the bathtub and I slipped and fucked my arm up. All right.
Owen's so concerned.
Oh, yeah. And Sarge being like, where's your x-rays? And Pillman being like, in the car? Where's your doctor's note? At the hotel.
So they have to do their match, and they just kind of do, like, headlocks and, like, really slow mat wrestling, which is perfect because they don't want to fight each other. And then eventually they do get into it because Marlena hits Owen from behind with her purse and, like, says Pillman did it. So they start fighting for a while. And then Goldust shows up. DQ. Owen wins. Pillman flees. Owen gets on the mic, dedicates the victory to his brother, the greatest world champion ever, Bret Hart. And then Austin shows up and beats down Owen. He dishes out an ass whipping. The police show up and we get a standoff between Austin and the cops. Cops don't draw their guns. That would have been a little too much, but they draw their nightsticks. And, like, Austin looks like he's legitimately about to fight all the cops in New York City before Vince McMahon gets up from the announcer's desk. And, again, the tone of the show totally changes. Vince gets into the ring, at which point I notice that he's wearing cargo pants.
He's wearing an outfit I've never seen on a human being before. Like, he's wearing, like a velvet, like, fleece jacket over a black shirt with, like, big baggy cargo pants. It's hard to imagine Vince McMahon ever wearing this.
Yeah. The Raw team jacket. And, like, I don't know why cargo pants instead of just, like, black dress pants, but I guess we're going for 90s edgy attitude stuff.
I bet he came in that day and was like, if I'm going to be a character, I better dress cool.
Yeah. You know, he tries to talk some sense into Austin. He's like, the reason we won't let you wrestle is because you're hurt. You could be paralyzed if you got back in the ring. you're not medically cleared. We're just doing this because we care. You know, Austin doesn't give a damn. Austin is, you know, this is my job. This is what I do for a living. This is all I want to do, and I'm the best in the world at it. You know, standoff, you know, Vince tells him, look, you may be the best, and someday you'll get to prove it, but you've got to work within the system. And Austin thinks about it and thinks about it, and in one of the most famous moments in history, tells Vince to kiss his ass and drops him with the stunner.
This is such a beautifully executed moment. And I think part of why it's so beautifully executed is because I think Vince McMahon in his head truly believed he was portraying a babyface here.
Yeah.
Like, he is all concern, all kind of like corporate help. Like, why don't you understand that this is how we do it in a corporate environment? And Austin is all unchecked in, you know, he's just so beautifully unpredictable. And fuck, man, when he drops him with that stunner, the crowd loses it.
Yeah, this is not they had started hinting Vince was the boss, like, in 96. Like, Diesel had made some shooty comments on his way out, and, you know, Sean had said some stuff. But, like, this is the first time they kind of lay their cards on the table that McMahon is the man in charge. And, like, it's a New York crowd, so they all know this. I don't know that this angle would have worked quite as well anywhere else.
Yeah, I agree. But, and like Bruce Pritchard always says on the Something to Wrestle podcast, like, they always told Vince, like, everybody knows you're the boss. It's just one of those things that, like, even if you're not really a fan of WWF, you know Vince is the boss. It's just common knowledge. And for them, they've never really done anything with it. And for them to use it here puts over Austin so enormously.
Yeah. Like, first guy to ever lay his hand. Brett had gotten his hands on Vince, but it was just like a quick little slap fight. This is like Austin knocked him out.
And like the shock that like JR greets this with, like, what the fuck did you just do? You can't do this.
There's a reason they've redone this angle 100 times over the years. They just did it again last week with Kevin Owens.
Yep.
And nastiest headbutt.
And it must be said, it will never, and occasionally it will catch fire because it's just such a brilliant to the point angle. And it's always going to be at least a little bit shocking to see the boss, like, get annihilated. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, at this point, it's kind of passe, but Vince hasn't been around very much. So it's a little more, like, this is the first time he got knocked out. And I don't know, it would have been since Roman did it the last time.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think that they've done a really good version of this since Randy punted him. Like, that was the last time, because that was the most brutal that it ever was.
The shock from that, because, yeah, that should have been Randy Orton's star-making moment, and they botched it.
Yep, they sure did. But, yeah, but, like, it's just such a perfect storm. Like, you see where Austin's coming from, you see where McMahon's coming from, but you want to pull for Austin. Like, this corporate bullshit keeping you from doing what you do thing, like, it's been said a million times, but it's something that everyone in the workforce can relate to on some level.
Yeah.
And it's, you just want to root for that guy who does what you would never do, but would always fantasize about doing. And, like, this is so perfect.
Yeah. Steve Austin, the ultimate working class hero, whereas Dusty Rhodes was, like, the positive version of the common man, Austin is like the 90s anti-hero version.
That is, Austin's the angry version. It's just so brilliant because he's just a normal guy with no filter, and it's just so perfect.
So he gets arrested. Like, we go to commercial, and then they do the intro package for the second hour, the War Zone. They come back and they kind of reset with King and JR at the announce table. I like that they're treating this like the world just ended, like an atomic bomb just went off. Like, he just it's like if Tom Brady beat up Roger Goodell.
Oh my God, WrestleMania, whatever's the next one, please.
Yeah. And then
actually, I don't know if we're ever going to address this again. Let me ask you real quick: why the fuck did they separate Raw into Raw and Warzone?
So that they could have two spots in the top-rated cable programs for the week.
I figured it was something like that. Okay, I had always wondered.
They would list both of them. Like, back in the day when you would actually look in the newspaper and see what the top-rated shows on cable TV were, they would list both Raw's War and the War Zone separately.
Got it. Makes sense.
Yeah. So Triple H comes out. I think it's the other thing was the second hour was rated PG-13 or whatever. Like, I don't
after
know
the 10, yeah.
System. Yeah, but the first hour was PG. So Triple H comes out for his street fight against Dude Love. This is also Falls Count Anywhere. Then we get the famous promo where all of Foley's personalities talk to each other. First, it's Dude Love, you know, wondering why he's not out there kicking some heavy duty booty. And now he, you know, says, you know, the whole street fight thing, not really the dude's style. He's more about the love. And so he brings in Mankind, and Mankind walks onto the set and sits down, and he and Dude talk to each other, and, you know, yeah, Mankind would be good for this, but there's someone even better. Ooh, can he bring him out? Oh, he can bring him out. Cactus Jack is back.
This is so cool. And it's actually so cool they'd wind up basically redoing it for the title feud against Cactus Jack at Street Fight in 2000. Like, where they basically do the exact same thing.
He
like, Cactus Jack is back.
The crowd. Yeah, pulled off the mask. And, yeah. Do you remember when Mick Foley interviewed himself in TNA, where it was like Mick Foley interviewing Cactus Jack?
I do.
How do you think that went over?
Not as well.
Yeah, it's tough. That was a low-tech version of this. I mean, I got to say, the production value for the 90s, this is impressive. Like, it's seamless.
I honestly didn't think that they were doing stuff like this in the 90s. So, like, it really is very impressive and a bit of an accomplishment. I would guess that part of the reason why they don't really focus in on the image too much is probably because you can, like, tell there's a little bit of green screen action going on.
There's a barrier between. There's a barrier, and there's the camera tricks they do. But, like, that's why it's a black backdrop, so you can't tell. But it comes off perfect. Like,
oh, it's great.
Fake. You say, wow, this looks really cool. And like Mick Foley, you're seeing his talent as a performer, how distinct these personas are.
And not to beat a dead horse, but seriously, try to imagine this today. Mick Foley, a person who they brought in and didn't have a ton of faith in right off the bat, comes in, does a really great job, and the artistic freedom that he has here is like unmatched to anybody else in like wrestling history. They're just like, do whatever you want. You have three different personas, cool. We'll use all three. Cut promos as all three of the versions of you. We'll use them all in storylines, interchangeably, whatever. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, it's unreal.
This is Cactus Jack, who has never been acknowledged on WWF TV before. Maybe they mentioned it a time or something when they were doing, like, the sit-down interviews with him. But, like, it's just, oh, yeah, Cactus Jack. And the crowd is nuclear when he comes out.
Like, huge ECW chants everywhere. This is another thing that, like, it's good that they did it here. And I've done this in Nebraska. You know what I mean? Like, it had to be in front of a New York or a Philly crowd. But over, and it works super well. But it's wild to me that Dude Love is a thing that exists. Like, it could never have existed at any other time in wrestling history.
What a weird, great character. Like, just, I don't usually like goofy stuff, but, like, Dude Love is, he pulls it off perfectly.
Yeah. And it just works so much better, too, because you know that underneath the Dude Love veneer is this, like, psychotic, crazy man.
Yeah. And his team with Austin, like, was...
Oh, so good.
They didn't get to... unfortunately, because of Austin's injury, they kind of just dumped it, so it didn't really get to go all the way. But, yeah, like, that was some really entertaining odd couple stuff. And this match is great. You know, if you're listening to this, you've probably seen it. It's a famous match. It's been on a lot of DVDs. They're fighting everywhere. They're fighting on the floor. They're fighting in the crowd. They're slamming each other on concrete. They fight backstage. This is all stuff that is not played out yet. You know, there have been hardcore matches by this point, but it's not like, you know, in 1999 when they were literally doing a hardcore title match on Raw every single week. It's still different to have crowd brawling, to have guys fighting backstage, pins on the floor. He slams Triple H through the barricade. The only way Triple H gets anything over is because China interferes. Triple H at one point sacrifices China to, like, slam Cactus into the steps through her. And that kind of ends up being his undoing because it takes her out. They fight up to the top of the stage where there's a table set up, but this isn't a gimmicky wrestling table. Like, this looks like a big giant wooden door.
And, like, there's so much that could have gone wrong with the finish to this match. So much. Like, if you've ever seen a Botchamania, you know exactly how vicious this could have looked.
Yeah. Like, that thing looks real creepy as they're fighting on it. Like, Triple H goes to pedigree him. Cactus gets him with a low blow. Pile drives him through the table. It breaks perfectly. You know, pile driver looked safe. And he pins him 1-2-3 on the top of the ramp. Great match.
Yeah. Like, as you said, before all of this stuff was played out completely, this is maybe like the most brutal match ever to air on WWE TV. So it's so interesting that it's here and that it's from this time, and it sort of intersects with like Austin coming up, and they're really starting to craft something that they don't know what it is yet. And I don't think that they've really started to like steal elements from ECW like they eventually would, but to like sort of further it. But like, they're really kind of touching on the Attitude Era without really knowing what they're doing. And it's great. Like, all the elements of this show that feature that kind of veneer are amazing.
Yeah. Like, we can debate like exactly when the Attitude Era started, but to me, by this point, there's no question that like, this is the Attitude Era. All of the elements are there.
Right. And this is definitely, this is one of the best Raw matches from this period. Might just be straight up one of the best matches from like this like kind of 4-year period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a classic, and overshadowed by the even better street fight they had at the Royal Rumble 2000, but that's one of the great WWF championship matches ever.
Agreed.
Sean comes out for another promo. I don't really know why.
Because he did so great the first time.
Yeah, it sort of felt like maybe they didn't feel like he'd hit his point before, because he literally says, as he's starting his promo, maybe I didn't make myself clear before.
And he doesn't really make himself clear here either.
No, I don't know what the fuck this is. He calls out The Undertaker. Someone from the crowd yells, "Sean is gay." And Sean responds, "Why don't you ask your mama if Sean is gay?"
And like,
I don't know if that's a good line or bad line.
I feel like it's a good line because, like, literally the crowd audibly goes, "Oh!"
He did kind of own that guy. Taker's music hits. I didn't like this. Triple H shows up to attack him. Like, Triple H should be in the hospital. He just got pile driven through a table.
Yeah, I guess the idea is that Shawn wanted to try this again so he could kind of trap The Undertaker with a beatdown. I didn't like Triple H coming out. I didn't like them getting the best of The Undertaker and beating the shit out of him. Like, it just made everyone look bad.
Yeah, this is strange. This would have been better at the beginning of the show than here. Anyway, they beat him down. Like, Michaels hits him with a chair. Rick Rude and Chyna show up, and they're laying it in, too. And then Taker eventually sits up and runs everybody off. Felt like they were just filling time here.
Agreed.
And now it's time for the main event. Bret Hart against Goldust. Title not on the line here. Bret Hart has a big flag match coming up against Vader and the Patriot, along with Davey Boy Smith. I can't even say it without laughing. Like, what?
The true American Vader.
Yeah, from the Rocky Mountains.
Holy shit.
The Patriot. What do you think of the Patriot?
Who's
not on this show, kind of weirdly.
I know that they had intended to go a lot further with him. I think he kind of got hurt, too. Is that what happened to him?
He wrecks his knee either in that match or, like, at a house show right afterward, and he ends up retiring.
I think they really planned to go all the way with him, and we probably got rescued from this, because I honestly, I'm afraid that they would have gone with Brett versus Del Wilkes instead of Brett versus Steve Austin at some point to blow off this storyline. What a fucking disaster that would have been.
I mean, he had a really great look, but the Patriot gimmick is so cheesy.
He's literally, like, it's never been more on the nose.
But as a face. Like, if they had brought Kurt Angle, Three Eyes Kurt Angle, in as a baby face.
Yeah, literally, it's even the same music. Like, it's Kurt Angle's music.
Yeah, so this match was strange because it's, you know, 10 minutes long, and I swear Goldust got in like two moves.
Goldust is made to look like such a chump on this show. Like, if this is the first episode of Raw you had ever seen, you would not think he was a credible star. He gets his ass kicked by everyone.
Yeah, they, like, it's just Brett works the leg and works the leg and works the leg. Shawn Michaels comes out and walks down the aisle as the show goes to commercial. Comes back from commercial. Brett's still working the leg. You flip to see what's going on Nitro. You come back. Brett's still working the leg. You go to get yourself a sandwich from the kitchen. You come back. Brett's still working the leg. Like, it just doesn't end.
This is actually, this might be like kind of a hot take or whatever. I think Brett really did them a favor by leaving for WCW because I don't think that Bret Hart was, his style was not made for the TV wrestling era. You know what I mean? Like, he's always been like a big match, pay-per-view, 20-minute match. Like, that's when you can kind of get a Bret Hart match and give the fans time to get into it. I don't think there's, aside from the one he had with the 1-2-3 Kid, I can't think of a good 6-minute Bret Hart match. You're not really getting him. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't work.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who just, it takes him a long time to really get going. Like, he's got to kind of work. It's the same with Flair. Like, Flair never really, I don't think, learned to work the TV match either. Like, Ric Flair matches are 30 minutes long.
Exactly. And I mean, it's just a different era. And obviously, like, when he left and it was focused on guys who could really do a better job of that, like, I'm not trying to disparage Brett by any means. He's one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. There's no argument there. But it's just not the right style. It didn't really work for him in WCW either. He just kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Because he doesn't look special during a TV match. That's not where he looks special.
Yeah. The crowd starts chanting faggot at Shawn.
Awesome. Yeah, good
not
crowd.
Not long after this, they would do the Brett promo where Brett would call Helmsley and Shawn a couple of homos. He did apologize for that in later years, so credit him for that. This is like the downside of this era.
This entire era is just like an act of trying to enjoy it amid self-hatred for being a wrestling fan during this period. Like, there's more so maybe than any other medium. Like, it's embarrassing to be a wrestling fan when stuff like this happens.
Yeah. Goldust finally makes a comeback. He hits an inverted atomic drop. And then Brett cuts him off, works the leg some more, and taps him out with the sharpshooter. I don't know what happened here. This was bizarre.
I don't know if they were trying, like, this is obviously a show that they're trying to pop a rating with, right? Like, this is the big deal show.
Yeah.
Why the fuck was this the main event then if they didn't want Goldust to look good?
Yeah, they're like, you easily could, the Austin segment easily could have closed the show. You could have had Owen and the Owen Pillman thing be the last match, and you've still had the promise that Austin is going to show up to keep people interested. Yeah, this was really weird.
But that said, I do like the last part of this, though.
Yeah, the massive brawl here. Shawn jumps Brett. DX runs out. The Hart Foundation comes out. Like, Neidhart gets a huge pop for some reason as he runs out shirtless in sweatpants.
He looks like he's 5'1" when he runs out there shirtless in sweatpants. He's just like, oh, here I am.
He's as wide as he is tall.
He got such a huge pop. I thought this was him re-debuting or something. Like, yeah,
me too. And then I was like, no, he's been back this whole time.
Like, that's just a bizarrely big pop. And then The Undertaker shows up and just obliterates literally everyone.
Yeah.
And does, like, the coolest double choke slam on Bret and Shawn. Loved it.
Yeah, like, just demolishes the two biggest stars in the company. Like, yeah, getting his heat back after he got tuned up in the last segment.
And see, this is great, great, great booking. Like, no other part of this feud going into Hell in a Cell has been any good at all. It's kind of all been shit. But this is great because The Undertaker is facing Shawn for the chance to get at Brett. Here he takes them both out, looks like the intimidating monster. This is perfect. Like, you cannot book, like, a go-home show, like, segment better than this. This is great.
Yeah, and it's just like, my God, like, what is he going to do to Shawn when they're locked in the cage together?
Exactly.
Yeah. So we're not really going to go into the fallout, because we'll explore that in 2 weeks when we cover Bad Blood 1997. I think it's notable there's no mention or hint or tease of Kane on this show.
There's really not even any like hint of Paul Bearer or anything. Like, The Undertaker is not involved in any of that kind of stuff. He's like so much more attached to like real life storylines now.
Yeah, Paul Bearer, I'm trying to think of it. I feel like maybe we hadn't seen him since he was managing Taker in the summer. He had blackmailed Undertaker into forcing him to take him back as his manager. And then I think he managed Vader at Canadian Stampede. That may have been the last time we had seen him. I don't remember if that was when Taker did the fireball. That may have been a few months before that. But yeah, Paul Bearer has kind of gone quiet at this point, but about to come back in a big way.
Yeah, at this exact moment in time, this is probably the least supernatural The Undertaker ever was until he became the American Badass. So it's just, and then comes Kane.
Yeah, but we'll get into all that in 2 weeks. Next week, we're going to look back at another critical moment in the NWO storyline when we cover Fall Brawl 1996. Kyush, you fired up for this one?
I'm unbelievably fired up for this one. There are like 5 to 10 storylines in the history of professional wrestling that like I could just sit down with you over a beer and just talk about for like 3 hours straight. And this is one of them. Like, this is the moment that Sting becomes Sting. Like, this is one of the great ways to end a pay-per-view, one of the great ways to build a main event storyline. Like, I cannot wait to rant about this all night long.
Yeah. So, main event, we've got Team WCW against Team NWO, Sting, Lex Luger, Ric Flair, and Arn Anderson against Hogan, Hall, Nash, and a mystery fourth man. You know, who has betrayed WCW this time? And also on the undercard, the Giant against Macho Man Randy Savage, Rey Mysterio against Super Kello, Chris Jericho against Chris Benoit in a great match that I don't think a lot of people have seen, and some other good, fun WCW mid-90s undercard stuff.
Including yet another Ice Train versus Scott Norton match.
They didn't settle the grudge the first time.
I do appreciate how during the course of this podcast, we just seem to cover the entire like run of a feud that sucks and we had no intention of covering.
Yeah. We have told at this point, we'll have told the entire Song of Ice and Fire.
The Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh boy. So you've got all that to look forward to next week. Kyush, anything you want to say before we wrap up?
Nope. I can't wait to get to that, and definitely go on the WWE Network and watch this show, but like he said earlier, if you can find a rip online with like the original TV commercials, watch that. Watch about like Tamagotchis and Cabbage Patch or whatever the hell was going on at this point. It's so much more fun that way.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you again next week.